From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is On Point. The Mueller report is on its way to Capitol Hill and is out to the American people. The roughly 400-plus page-turner is expected to lay out evidence about President Trump's efforts to control the investigation into obstruction of justice, which Robert Mueller has left open for others to decide. It'll also shed light on Russian interference in the 2016 election. Here's Attorney General William Barr a little over an hour ago.
After nearly 2 years of investigation, thousands of subpoenas, hundreds of warrants and witness interviews, the special counsel confirmed that the Russian government sponsored efforts to illegally interfere with the 2016 presidential election, but did not find that the Trump campaign or other Americans colluded in those efforts.
This hour on Point, high stakes and the Mueller report. Join us as we parse this together call in and let us know. Will the report change your mind about this president, the special counsel, Congress? Join us anytime on onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're going to start off with McKay Coppins, a staff writer at The Atlantic. He joins us from Alexandria, Virginia via Skype. McKay, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And if at any point you want to point out something that you find compelling in this report, you can chime in to me and we will get to that and we will be looking at this as we go along this hour. We appreciate that. And so first I want to point out something that Attorney General Barr said last hour when he gave that press conference. He said, given the limited nature of the redactions in the special counsel Robert Mueller's report, he believes the publicly released version will allow every American to understand the results of Mueller's investigation.
Nevertheless, in an effort to accommodate congressional requests, we will make available, subject to appropriate safeguards, to a bipartisan group of leaders from several congressional committees, a version of the report with all redactions removed, except those relating to grand jury information.
Now, Barr said those redactions by law cannot be shared from that one category. So now members of Congress are getting, depending who they are, either the fully redacted report or a little bit less redacted report as folks like us are parsing this report. McKay, what do you expect to happen next?
Well, you know, obviously all of us, including myself, as you were just talking there, are poring over this report. And I think that in the coming hours, we'll see media outlets pull out kind of the big revelations or the key points. And then we'll start to see the political and partisan process kind of churn into gear. Certainly, members of Congress are going to pick out the bits that conform to their narratives and kind of amplify those. The partisan media will do the same. But hopefully, I think we're going to be having a debate that goes beyond the questions of legality, right? Mm-hmm. And more into the questions of the president's character, the president's behavior, and the behavior of those around the president, both during the campaign and in the White House. I think that, you know, one of the central questions that's hovered over this president throughout his time in office has been, it has been to what extent we're okay as Americans with him kind of shredding the conventional norms of the presidency. And I think that a lot of those norms are going to be show up throughout this report. And I think we'll be having a broader conversation that goes beyond legality and into kind of ethical behavior and moral behavior and his fitness for office.
Well, one thing that has become a norm for this presidency is the president's use of Twitter. Since Attorney General Barr's press conference, the president has tweeted and pinned to the top of his feed a Game of Thrones themed visual that says no collusion, no obstruction for the haters in the radical left Democrats. Game over. That's clearly his way to frame this. But McKay, one thing leading up to this morning that I've seen a lot of discussion about is the press, how the press is going to cover this report. Will there be a rush or will reporters take the time to stop and read 400 plus pages, digest it, and only then put forward what the impact of this is going to be? How do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, look, in a perfect world, we wouldn't all be on the air talking about this right now, right? I have MSNBC up on my TV right now, and they were literally had the document up on the screen, and they're scrolling through the document for viewers to see, clearly kind of trying to, in the industry, we call this vamping, right?
Yes.
They're trying to buy time as the journalists and experts that they have on staff, just as this show has plenty of experts, actually take time to read through and quickly digest what's in here. You know, I hope that we are all trying to be careful about not drawing big definitive conclusions until we're able to get through the report. But this is why I said the kind of the way that our system works now, the way the media complex works, I think already on Twitter, you're seeing screenshots of and little grabs of snatches of quotes from the report flying around Twitter. And I think that this is going to be a pretty chaotic 24 hours.
Well, I'm going to grab a little bit from the Washington Post that they've put up. It says Mueller considered Trump's written answers, quote, inadequate, but knew that a subpoena would impose substantial delay, according to the report. It also says the special counsel team wrote in the newly released report that Trump stated more than 30 times that he does not recall or remember or have an independent recollection of information investigators asked about. But they wrote that they chose not to pursue a subpoena because of the substantial delay and that such a step would cause, and decided that they have sufficient evidence to understand the relevant events and to make certain assessments without the president's testimony. Clearly, they anticipated that question, why the president was only allowed to submit written answers and did not testify himself, they knew they had to explain that, McKay.
Right. And I know from my own reporting and others reporting that the people around the president, the thing they were most worried about in all of this investigation was a situation where the president is under oath and falls into gets into a situation where he's saying untrue things under oath. Right.
Right.
And this is a president who is not known for the discipline of his words. He is known to get distracted, to hyperbolize and exaggerate and lie. And there was a lot of fear from the president's lawyers and the people on his political team that that more than anything else posed an existential threat to his presidency. And so they did all they could to keep him out of that situation.
His attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and others frequently called that a perjury trap.
Yes, right.
To have him come in. Well, joining us from NPR West in Culver City, California, is Jessica Levinson. She's a professor of law at Loyola Marymount University. Jessica, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So far from the press conference with the attorney general and what little you've gleaned in the few minutes that this report has come out, what is your initial reaction?
Yes, I have to say I was thrilled by the length of your discussion previously because it gave me some time to at least go through the report. So what I've gleaned, frankly, from the press conference is that I think if you look at the president and who have been his best appointees, I think that Bill Barr has been enormously useful to the president. He got out in front of the report by putting out that 4-page summary that dominated the narrative for weeks now. And then before any of us had a chance to even look at the report, he has put out essentially a press release, almost that you would see more from a crisis management firm than from the attorney general, trying to phrase the report. Now, what I've seen from the report and what we've discussed is answering one of the questions I think is most interesting, which is why didn't Robert Mueller come to a conclusion when it came to obstruction of justice? Mm-hmm. And I think that we're able to zero in now. And I want to caveat everything with I think, because I'm not at page 448 yet.
Sure, of course.
I think that what we're zeroing in on, it's this issue that's the hardest to prove for obstruction of justice, which is corrupt intent. And it's very difficult to prove that when you have not had a sit down with the person who might be indicted on obstruction of justice. And so I do think it's important for us to remember that asking someone to testify in real time is not a perjury trap. It's asking them to provide information in a verbal form. It's only a perjury trap if you think that that person might contradict their statements. I don't think that any member of the Mueller team was trying to play a gotcha game. And I think that's important for us to remember, particularly when we're going to see a response from the president today.
And Jessica, on the point of that interview not taking place, what do you think about the explanation that we've seen from the excerpts of the reporting here, to be sure, that the special counsel was worried about the delay, that attempting to subpoena the president and force him to testify would do to the investigation? Do you think that there's a trade-off there? There might be a delay, but at the other hand, as you said, you really need in-person testimony to get to that that mens rea, as us legal folks say, of behind that charge.
Well, I think for me, you know, what I thought is, I understand, because there was this feeling by the American public, and I think that's largely because the president and the administration was very effective at conveying the idea that this investigation was dragging on. There was a feeling that we need to wrap this up. If you look at the scope of the investigation, the number of interviews, indictments, etc., this was actually an incredibly quick and efficient investigation. Under 2 years for something of this size and scope is very efficient. But to me, it indicates, if the reporting is accurate, that Robert Mueller is a human being and he understood and felt the pressure to try and wrap this up, and maybe didn't want to go through a subpoena fight with the president of the United States.
All right, McKay and Jessica, hold, stick with us. We're going to talk about this big day in Washington and the country as the Mueller report hits the public. You can join the conversation. What questions do you want answered in the report? I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. The Mueller report is out. You can join the conversation. Attorney General William Barr said this morning that the White House fully cooperated with the special counsel's investigation. Do you agree? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're talking with Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Marymount University Law School, and with McKay Coppins, staff writer at The Atlantic. Just a little bit more that we are learning from the report as reporters and others parse it. This is from MSNBC. They report that President Trump immediately wanted to get rid of Jeff Sessions, saying that he was expletive as soon as he heard about the special counsel probe. We'll keep this family safe, so I won't use the word, but you kind of get an idea of what is coming out from this report. The president himself spoke about it for the first time just moments ago. He was speaking in the White House East Room to participants of the Wounded Warrior Project Soldier Ride.
No collusion, no obstruction. There never was, by the way, and there never will be.
President Trump was addressing this two-year investigation that wrapped up with the release of this report today. Here's more from those remarks in the East Room.
This should never happen to another president again. This hoax. This should never happen to another president again. Thank you.
So, McKay, this reaction from the president, is it what you expected?
Yes, because it's fairly consistent with his reactions to this investigation throughout, and certainly in the last month since we got that summary memo from the attorney general. I do think that as the actual facts in this this 448-page report begin to trickle out, and as they're contextualized and amplified, that kind of triumphalist response from the president is going to be tested. It was a lot easier for him to kind of take a victory lap when all we knew was what the attorney general had told us about the report. Now that we're actually seeing kind of the dirty laundry be aired to the extent that it's not redacted, I think that it's going to be a much more muddled picture. And I think that the White House seems to know that. I think that sending the attorney general out the way he did to act in a way that at least a lot of people in this country and certainly a lot of people in the press could reasonably interpret as a pretty partisan means that the White House is fine to fight to a draw on this. They don't expect to win over the country to their conclusion that there was nothing bad found, no bad behavior found in this report, but they're fine with their base believing it and their opponents not believing it and muddying up the waters enough that we can all just kind of move on. I think that's the strategy we're seeing here.
All right, let's go to the phones. Logan is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Hi, Logan.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to make my comment on this. I love NPR, I really do, but this narrative going on discrediting Barr, it's just distasteful in my opinion, I guess. I guess I've heard him speak publicly both times he's come out, and you know, it doesn't sound to me like he's defending the president. It sounds like maybe he's trying to get, you know, ahead of this thing and tamp down some of the political war going on over this thing. To me, he sounds like he understands and he respects the law. And I just hope that once we get done reading this report and talking about it, that we can finally just put this to rest and move on and move on to a new subject. And then that's all I have.
All right, Logan, thank you for that call. John is calling from Amherst, New York. Hi there, John.
Hi. I'd like to kind of reference, you know, I've listened to all the guests and everyone seems to have a slant where they do believe that, Trump did something felonious or something like that. I am curious, and I want a direct answer from everyone, the law professor, the reporter from the Post, I don't care who it is. This whole FISA request was completely, this whole Steele dossier was completely debunked. Now, I hear people on the left saying that it really wasn't. Oh, no, it's been all true. Nothing in it is true. It was paid for by the Clinton campaign through a shell law firm. So when they filed for the FISA report, they actually lied about where it came from. Or the FISA judge just let it slide. But it was a bought and paid for dossier, and that's what did the whole thing. I don't want to hear George Papadopoulos or whatever his name is, because that was a shill too, because he was set up at a bar about some Clinton emails that everyone knew about 2 weeks prior to them even talking.
All right.
So I want to know if these guys are curious about the FISA request. And it was bought and paid for by Democrats.
All right. I want to give our guest a chance to respond to that. McKay, I'm going to start with you, and then I'll go to Jessica.
Well, there's a lot to unpack there. I think that I'm not going to speculate about the Steele memo just because I haven't gotten to its mention in the report, the mentions of it. In the report, if there are mentions. What I will say is that I think that the Steele memo has been used in probably a less than good faith manner by both conservatives and liberals throughout this investigation. I think that some of the president's allies and defenders have used it as a bit of a straw man, trying to cast the entire Russia investigation as something that was based on the Steele memo, when in fact we've learned that that's not necessarily the case. And then I think liberals have at least some liberals have gotten too far ahead of themselves by amplifying claims in the memo that simply have never been established or confirmed. But I mean, this is why we have the special counsel, right? We had Robert Mueller and this team of highly credentialed, nonpartisan figures look into this, dig into this, and come up with their own report. And now it's just been released to the public. And I hope that we can focus on what was actually in that report, as opposed to what was in this memo, in the Steele memo, which was, I think, has been discredited to some extent, but also, doesn't need to be the main thing that we're still fighting about.
Jessica, the caller talked about these FISA requests, and this is clearly an issue that I think we'll hear more of from the White House. They've already seized upon Attorney General Barr using the word spying in describing what happened, although the Attorney General did not say he knew anything illegal took place. How do you see that part of this playing out?
Well, I think, one, it's interesting that Attorney General Barr has adopted the language of spying as opposed to surveillance, because that is really a distinction with a difference. But I would say also with respect to the issues of the Steele dossier, I absolutely agree with the point that, like everything else in American 2019, this has been, frankly, misused by both sides of the aisle. But I would say the fact that a report is paid for by opposition does not undercut everything in the report. It just means that you have to look at it and assess its credibility. And in fact, what we know is that the FISA judges were aware of the fact that this was essentially opposition research. That doesn't undercut whether or not it's the veracity of that report. You also, if you look at the FISA court and you disagree with what they're doing, you essentially have to say, I'm not comfortable with the judgment of a number of different federal judges. So I think that there's a lot of things that we're looking at today with respect to, you know, the dossier and the report. I would also want to remind people, obviously, this is the news of the day. It's the news of the week. It's likely going to be the news of the month. But what Robert Mueller was looking at was actually quite narrow. It was just these two questions of whether or not there was conspiracy. Finally, the memo explains to all of us that collusion is, in fact, not a crime, that collusion is not the word we should use, and whether or not there was obstruction of justice on fairly narrow grounds. But the entire ambit of possible legal exposure that President Trump has is actually much broader. And I think that we have not done ourselves any favors by both sides kind of hinging everything on the Mueller report while ignoring all the other potential avenues of investigation and prosecution.
Okay, I want to go to the calls. Joel is calling from Richmond, Virginia. Hi there, Joel.
Hi, Kim. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. So I guess I just preface this by saying that I'm a lifetime progressive leftist, but I'd like to switch focus for a second to the other side of things, right? We've talked a lot about Trump and Barr on this program, but I'd like to switch focus to the Democrats, right? So as I watch this unfold, I can't help but wonder if the Democrats are using this to save face after the loss of Hillary Clinton, to delegitimize criticisms of her and the weak candidates they've kind of put on the ballot in the past few years, and to distract from the egregious rigging of the primaries in 2016. So I guess my question is, do you think that their motives are purely altruistic, or do you think that there may be some political motives behind this investigation?
Joel, I'm going to put that to McKay. Go ahead.
You know, I'm not going to worry about the political motives. I think that the investigation was undertaken for with legitimate reasons. I think that certainly there has been partisan politics have been played, but I'm not going to go so far out on a limb as to impugn the motives of everyone involved. And I understand the skepticism and the frustration, but that's a little bit further than I'm willing to go unless I'm, you know, out there kind of reporting it out.
A little excerpt as it comes out, this from the Washington Post. It says, repeatedly, it appears Trump may have been saved from more serious legal jeopardy by his own staffers who refused to carry out orders they thought were problematic or legally dangerous. Jessica, I want to ask you broadly about how some actions of others might have saved the president, or we were wondering before this report came out whether some actions of his staff may be problematic to him, including that meeting in Trump Tower that took place with members of his campaign team and Russian nationals. Talk about sort of how one could have, how he may have been saved by what those around him did.
Well, I think on a number of different situations, I mean, potentially the Trump Tower meeting and other, frankly, other activities throughout the campaign and the presidency, we've seen the president's staff essentially try and guard against certain behavior. I'm thinking most recently the news that came out was the president perhaps jokingly dangling a pardon before a official of the Customs and Border Patrol, saying if you close the border and you get into any sort of legal problems, which of course you would if you close the border, I'll give you a pardon. And then the staff kind of pulling back on that and saying that was a joke. I think that we've seen a number of different situations, for instance, in terms of the first travel ban, where the staff has played two different roles, perhaps bringing President Trump to the brink of legal jeopardy, like we saw in the first travel ban, and then bringing him back, where either we have the staff saying, we're not going to carry out that order. I'm thinking of the anonymous op-ed from the New York Times.
Right.
Or the staff explaining to him, for instance, most recently, where President Trump said that he wanted to put illegal immigrants and undocumented workers in sanctuary cities and sanctuary states, that actually would fly in the face of federal law, and essentially explaining that can't happen. And so then you would see the president kind of go up and back, but ultimately pull back. And I think that when it comes to these really delicate questions, for instance, the conspiracy between the Trump campaign and the Russian government, to come back to today, and obviously these issues of obstruction, I believe the story, you know, if we look a week from now, will probably be that the staff really did help a lot more than it hurt because of this idea of pulling back, of potentially not carrying out orders, of explaining to the president why certain conduct is problematic. You have to assume that when the press saw that interview with Lester Holt, where the president said, you know, I got rid of James Comey, so this Russia thing went away, that there was a lot of cringing in the room when that was aired.
Yeah, yeah. I want to get to a couple of more excerpts through the press that we are seeing from this and then ask McKay about them. CNN is reporting that Mueller was unable to conclude that no criminal conduct occurred when it came to obstruction. We have this excerpt of the report itself as reported by The Wall Street Journal. It says, we recognize that a federal criminal accusation against a sitting president would place burdens on the president's capacity to govern and potentially preempt constitutional processes for addressing presidential misconduct, the report says. The report said the investigators didn't believe the evidence exonerated Mr. Trump. It says, quote, if we had confidence after a thorough investigation of the facts that the president clearly did not commit obstruction of justice, we would so state. McKay, how do you think that is going to be treated by Congress and the public?
Well, that is key right there. And it's something that the attorney general kind of gestured toward in his first letter to Congress a month ago. But that's really important because what you've seen in the past month is the president and his allies going around the country, going on TV, going to rallies, saying that this report has fully exonerated President Trump. And in fact, this report says the exact opposite. It says that we were unable, as you just read, we were unable to exonerate him. And if we could have exonerated him, we would have said that, right? And so I think that is worth bearing in mind as you see some of the partisan spin that's going to come out from the right in the coming days and weeks, that just because this special counsel wasn't able or willing to fully assert that there were crimes committed, they also said very clearly that they weren't ready to say definitively that crimes weren't committed. And frankly, that is actually one of the big frustrations, I think, on the left and for a lot of people who were putting a lot of faith in this report and this process, that there was no traditional prosecutorial judgment that was rendered.
All right. McKay Coppins, staff writer at The Atlantic and author of The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. That's quite a tongue twister, McKay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kim.
We're going to ask Jessica Levinson of Loyola Marymount University Law School to stick with us. We are poring over the Mueller report. You can join the conversation in 10, 20, 50 years. How will history look back on this report, this moment in our nation's history? How are you looking at it right now? I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. You can join the conversation. What's your question for the panel, the country? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio as we continue to talk about the Mueller report as we get a first look at it just this hour. We're talking with Jessica Levinson, a professor at Loyola Marymount University Law School in Atlanta. I will get that right one of these days, Jessica. And joining us now from Washington is Ginger Gibson, national political correspondent for Reuters. Welcome, Ginger. Thanks for joining us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So far from what you've been able to parse with your speed reading skills from this report, have you come across anything yet that you think, what do you think is the biggest takeaway so far?
It is 448 pages, and I can tell you there's a team of reporters in our newsroom currently scouring over this report. A little premature maybe to say what the most interesting thing is, but I can tell you some highlights that I have seen so far, one of which was that Donald Trump Jr. was in communication, had correspondences with WikiLeaks during the campaign. He alerted other campaign staff that he had received a direct message on Twitter from WikiLeaks that they had sent him a password to access a website that was critical of the president, then candidate Donald Trump, that he had used that password, that it had worked and allowed him to access that website. In another communication, WikiLeaks asked Don Jr. to tweet a link to the hacked emails of John Podesta, and that 4 days later he had, in fact, sent that link. Separate from these conversations, WikiLeaks, we're also finding out a lot about conversations and internal discussions that were happening inside the White House as the special counsel was being named. We've learned that President Trump instructed his counsel, Don McGahn, to fire Mueller, that McGahn, in turn, ignored that request, concerned, quote, that he would have another Saturday night massacre. He opted instead to ignore him, and then Trump never came back and asked about it again.
Yes. And in addition to that point about McGahn balking at an order to dismiss Mueller, the New York Times is reporting that President Trump also likely fired James Comey for refusing to clear the president's name. The Times reports that substantial evidence indicates that the catalyst for the president's decision to fire Comey was Comey's unwillingness to publicly state that the president was not personally under investigation, despite the president's repeated requests that Comey make such an announcement. Jessica, I want to turn to you. We have this issue of obstruction, which was left open by the special counsel. When you see evidence like that, or reported evidence at this point, right, of that, what do you think about that in terms of obstruction?
Well, I think it's hugely problematic. I mean, I keep thinking as we're having this discussion that there's going to be this huge disparity between the headlines and the actual report, and that that disparity will actually be, I think, an uphill battle for critics of the president and Democrats. Because if you look at the headlines, it is no prosecutorial finding that there's enough evidence for conspiracy, certainly a lot of evidence, but maybe not enough to charge. And then for obstruction of justice, that they didn't come to a conclusion for a variety of reasons. And one of which, this idea that it should be left to the political branches, obviously is a more than a wink and a nod towards the possibility of impeachment. But if you look at just the headline, it's the president's not going to be indicted, and that decision doesn't turn on the fact that he's president, and we think the president can't be indicted. If you look at the actual report, there's so much problematic behavior. I mean, I'm just pouring through it now. Any one of these paragraphs, I think, in another administration would be what dominates months, if not years, and plagues a president. But I think that for Democrats politically, they're going to have to really thread a needle of trying to explain the problematic behavior to the American public without sounding like sore losers, without sounding like people who can't just get over it, and frankly, with an eye towards still understanding that they need to explain to their voters why their platform isn't just, look, there was a lot of wrongdoing in the Mueller report, but also, here's how I'm going to make your daily life better if you elect me or reelect me.
Ginger, just sort of looking as more information comes out, I see CNN is reporting that, according to Mueller, Congress has the ability to find that the president obstructed justice. Attorney General Barr said in his press conference today essentially that that was his call, that it was not Congress's. Do you see a fight playing out there?
Well, Barr can say what he wants. Congress is an independent and separate branch of government that can do whatever they want. He doesn't really get to determine. I mean, we really have to remember, and it's important to remember, that when Barr makes decisions, he's acting as a prosecutor, and he's making legal determinations about how things hold up in a court of law. Congress doesn't make those kind of decisions. They're largely making political decisions, and I mean political decisions with a little p in the academic sense. Impeachment is a political process. Having hearings and going through a review in Congress is a political process. They can act independently and separately of the president, and let's be, I mean, of the administration, of the Justice Department. And let's be clear, the kind of standards that a prosecutor and a court is going to use to determine something like obstruction of justice aren't necessarily the same things that Congress is going to use, because they're not really enforcing the law. They're not a court of law. We have seen Nancy Pelosi say pretty clearly that she doesn't intend that Congress would execute some type of impeachment. And I think the point just made was really important, which is that Democrats are going to be trying to find a way to explain what they think is wrong to their readers, their voters, explain what they think is problematic in the president's behavior. They will be able to potentially reconstruct some of these conversations in a hearing format, and that would allow them to maybe illustrate what they think was problematic in this behavior without having to get into sort of the legal processes that we saw Barr trying to explain today.
Let's get back to the phones. Anthony is calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Thanks for the call, Anthony.
Hi, Kim. My question, is there anything in United States law that could block Congress if they were to call Mueller to testify that could block them from compelling Mueller to answer all of their questions, and specifically regarding things that are redacted that that otherwise may never come out or would take very long. Is there anything in the law that would block Congress from being able to do that, to get Mueller in to testify and answer all their questions?
Yeah, Jessica, you are our legal expert this hour. What do you think?
Well, so I'm going to give you everybody's least favorite answer from a lawyer, which is yes and no, and or it depends. And this is what it depends on. So absolutely, Congress has subpoena authority, as your caller knows. Congress can subpoena Robert Mueller and say, please come and testify. And we want to hear from you. And if you don't comply with the subpoena, we can hold you in contempt of Congress and potentially we can go to court. Now, in terms of what Robert Mueller actually can be forced to say, he is still subject to all of the privilege concerns and privacy concerns that we've seen Attorney General Barr talk about in terms of the redaction. So Robert Mueller, for instance, without an exception, would have to respect the fact that grand jury proceedings are secret. Robert Mueller would want to say, that's a national security concern, and I don't want to speak to that. So he would absolutely have to answer certain questions, but then there are other questions that might fall within these buckets of either privilege or overriding privacy, like national security concerns, harms to ongoing investigations, where I think Robert Mueller could, under the law, absolutely say, I'm not at liberty to answer that.
Ginger, we have heard the president say and seen him tweet the term no collusion over and over again over the last 2 years. I want to read you this excerpt from the Washington Post that's important to that point. It says Mueller's team looked for tacit or express agreement with Russians, not collusion. In an executive summary, Mueller's team clearly stated that they did not believe collusion, which President Trump has incessantly insisted he did not commit, to be a legal term. For that reason, prosecutors did not assess whether Trump's campaign colluded with Russia. Does that undercut the president's argument?
You know, what we're going to see here is a bit of a vocabulary fight, I think. President Trump says no collusion. Democrats are going to say, well, of course not, because no one was looking to see if you committed collusion. I think what is going to be really telling for the president going forward is that when these narratives, when we can see, as this reporting includes, communications that Don Jr. was having, the things he was sending back and forth with WikiLeaks. Does a voter read those conversations and say, that's unsavory, I don't like that conversation? Or do they say, you know what, I believe the president that was inclusion, and I don't think that's a problem? We really are getting not just vocabulary terms now, but a real look at what those conversations were.
All right, Mel is calling from Syracuse, New York. Hi, Mel.
Hi, Kimberly. You guys covered one of my questions, and I was this morning, Attorney William Barr was speaking on the WikiLeaks dumps, and it seemed like he was providing cover. And so now my question is, with the revelations, is that not obstruction if there were these ties to the WikiLeaks dumps?
Yeah, I'm going to put this question to Jessica. What we have been hearing reporting about potential connections with WikiLeaks, with Donald Trump Jr., with Roger Stone. What do you think it would have taken for that to amount to some sort of criminal conspiracy, which is the legal term, not collusion? And why did it not reach that point in the eyes of Special Counsel Mueller?
Yeah. So first, let me say I'm so overjoyed that we are finally using the word conspiracy. This has been one of the things that, I fear that this is going to be on my tombstone, said forever. We shouldn't use the word collusion because that's not a crime. And so when it comes to, and frankly, I mean, the president was just brilliant about doing this, saying no collusion. Well, that's exactly right. Collusion is only a legal issue when it comes to antitrust law. But to your caller's question, if I was able to hear it correctly, this issue of conspiracy, it has to be conspiracy to do X. We need to find a statutory bucket to put that conspiracy in. So it has to be, for instance, conspiracy to violate federal laws concerning computer hacking, federal election laws. And in terms of how you define the agreement, which in this case I think was defined in a fairly difficult way to satisfy, that you need either an express or tacit agreement, essentially kind of you need a smoking gun agreement. And then you need to find a statute to hinge that problematic agreement on. I think it creates a high bar. And I also think that in a number of the circumstances, and I again, I've been reading as quickly as I can, what potentially we've seen with respect to Don Jr. is that one of the things, and this is what I think progressives and Democrats have worried about, one of the things that might save President Trump and or members of his campaign and family is this idea that you have to really know a little something about the law in order to violate it. And I think that's potentially what we've seen with respect to obstruction of justice and the president, and maybe with respect to what we're seeing in terms of lack of conspiracy when it comes to this Trump Tower meeting, that in a way, the less you understand it, and again, big caveat of we still need to pore over the report, but in a way, the less you understand, the better for your defense.
I want to try to get another call in. Glenn is calling from Old Lyme, Connecticut. Hi, Glenn.
Yeah, hi, Kim. Thanks for taking my call. So what I've noticed from a lot of mainstream and other media outlets is sort of this dualistic discussion, you know, collusion, no collusion, conspiracy, no conspiracy, and the conversation tends to stop there. It seems to me that there's a lot more kind of shades of gray here. You know, there's certainly the potential for intentional criminal activity, unintentional criminal activity, and then below all that are these sort of checkpoints where, you know, is this just simply unethical, which I'm sure in some cases it was, or questionable, or is it truly impeachable? And, you know, just my request to the broader media is to really, you know, get into some of that nuanced discussion and really spend the time to kind of begin turning over a lot of these different stones.
Well, Glenn, I'm going to give Ginger a chance in under a minute to try to give some of that nuance moving forward. How might these scenarios play out, Ginger?
I think the nuance is going to be involved people reading a lot, because we're going to spill a lot of ink on these, on this nuance in the next few days. And it's also going to involve people paying attention to more than just the headline and really looking at how this, what we're still talking about 2 days from now, what we're still talking about 3 days from now, and how that affects the fabric of the conversation.
And overall, as you are pouring through this now, Ginger, what do you think, how do you think this is going to impact the election? I mean, that's just next year. A lot of people are looking at it through this lens. Some of our listeners online have asked that question.
I think it's going to be important to see how the president responds, how his opponents respond, and whether or not this starts turning people off. I think a lot of Trump's independent voters, people who are not particularly partisan, want him to be able to do things. They believe he's done great things for the economy. If they think he can keep doing that, they'll vote for him again. If they think this report and these details will hamstring him indefinitely, then he might start losing some of their support.
All right. Ginger Gibson, national political correspondent for Reuters. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Professor Jessica Levinson of Loyola Marymount University Law School. We really appreciate your time and expertise. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.